You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 13th of March 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I am Markus Hippi. On today's show, a plane that is still missing, a pope that celebrates 1 year in office, and a country that has become an expert in evading UN sanctions, that is North Korea of course. Matthew Jameson and Alessio Batalano will join me to look at the biggest stories of the day. We'll also discuss allegations that it was Iran, not Libya, who ordered the Lockerbie bombing.
The target was to copy exactly that what happened to the Iranian Airbus. Everything exactly same, minimum 219 people dead.
And later in the show we'll speak to author Agata Bisic, who argues that the old division between East and Western Europe still exists in her book Poor But Sexy. Plus we'll be in Greece and Parul Segar from the New York Times will give us some book recommendations. That is Midori House with me, Markus Hippi, right now. So lots coming up in the next hour here on Midori House, but before all that, here is David Spencer with the latest news.
Monocle 24 News, I'm David Spencer. One of the most powerful businessmen in Germany, Bayern Munich president Uli Hoeneß, has been convicted of tax evasion. He's been sentenced to 3.5 years in jail after admitting to evading 27.2 million euros in tax on income earned in secret Swiss bank accounts. The 62-year-old, who won the World Cup with Germany, bowed his head and stared at the floor when the verdict was delivered. His defence lawyers say they will appeal to the Federal Court of Justice. Russia has announced it started military exercises near the border with Ukraine in what is likely to be seen as a show of force in the standoff with Kiev and the West over Crimea. The Defence Ministry in Moscow confirmed more than 8,000 military personnel are involved. Meanwhile, Ukraine's parliament has voted to create a 60,000-strong National Guard. That vote comes ahead of Sunday's referendum in Crimea, now controlled by pro-Moscow forces, on whether citizens want to join Russia. Search crews are continuing to pick through the rubble from a building collapse in New York City, in which 7 people died. 60 people were also injured in the suspected gas explosion in Harlem. 5 people are still missing. People who live in the neighborhood and witnessed the explosion are still shaken a day later.
When we got up here, we just saw this whole building. I mean, it exploded and then it just came down like a deck of cards.
It's a tragedy because, I mean, nobody expected this.
So I hope some of the families are okay. And my condolences to the ones who weren't okay, you know. Let's keep our prayers alive.
The whole scene, it was something like out of a disaster movie, if you could only imagine it.
The United States says a new search area may be opened in the Indian Ocean as authorities try to determine what happened to the missing Malaysian airliner. The White House said this was based on new information, but didn't specify what that was. Earlier, Malaysian authorities said photographs taken by a Chinese satellite showing objects in the South China Sea were not related to the airliner's disappearance. The Boeing 777 vanished last week with 239 people on board. Turkish Prime Minister Tayyip Erdogan has condemned anti-government protesters as charlatans bent on causing chaos in the run-up to local elections. He was speaking after the country's worst civil unrest since mass protests last summer, with 2 people killed on Wednesday. A police officer died in eastern Turkey after suffering a heart attack, and a 22-year-old man was shot in Istanbul in an apparent standoff with a group of anti-government protesters. The United Nations World Food Programme says it succeeded in reaching many areas of Syria that have been inaccessible for months. But it says delivering aid to people in desperate need remains a challenge as the conflict continues. The deliveries have been helped by locally negotiated ceasefires, allowing convoys into previously restricted areas. WFP spokesperson Dina Al-Kasabi.
Across the country, the World Food Programme is aiming to reach over 4 million people every month. But the greatest challenges we're facing right now are insecurity and access to besieged communities, because one-off and sporadic convoys and deliveries to people in need are not enough. We need constant access, monthly access, to families all across the country.
Dina Al-Kassabi from the United Nations World Food Programme. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, David Spencer. We'll get more news headlines from David in 25 minutes. You are listening to Midori House. You're on Monocle 24. We are back right after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 18.06 and it is 14.06 in New York. Joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is Matthew Jameson, Consultant Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute, and Alessia Batalana, Professor of War Studies at King's College London. Welcome both to the programme. Good to have you both here again.
Good afternoon.
Well, confusion continues to surround the disappearance of flight MH370 from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing last Friday. For the latest, the focus of the search has now shifted towards the Indian Ocean. Yes, an area nearly 10,000 kilometers wide. A report by the Wall Street Journal has alleged that the plane remained aloft for several hours as Rolls-Royce, the maker of the aircraft's engine, continued to receive data transmissions from the plane's engine hours after the cockpit was lost. But those allegations have been denied by the chief executive of Malaysia Airlines, and nothing has come out of the images recorded by Chinese satellites that seem to show large floating objects in the South China Sea. The theories around this disappearance continue to flourish, and terrorism hasn't been ruled out either. Let's start by looking at the security issues here. Alessia, you specialise in maritime warfare. What is your take on this situation?
Well, you know, we spoke about this a few days ago. I think one of the key issues that we're looking at is one where you have, first of all, the security protocol in the airport. So we knew from the beginning about the stolen identities, the passports that were faked, and that already raised a little bit of sort of doubts about how good sort of international standards were implemented across the world. And then you've got the second element here. We're talking about something that is pretty sizable. It's got quite a few people. All of a sudden, it disappears. What I find extremely interesting is that with all the civilian authorities and air traffic control, it is becoming extremely difficult to have an idea of about 4 hours around the disappearance of the flight. That is quite staggering if you think that we live in a world where we can't really make a step without everybody knows about it.
Mm-hmm. And when you look at the situation where the authorities are in the region, what do you think? How worried are they about the simple fact that we have a disappeared plane over there and all of a sudden no one knows why? Obviously something's gone wrong, but we don't know what exactly has happened.
I think that there is quite a sense of concern, deep concern, and also just utter bafflement and confusion, as you say, because the fact of the matter is nobody really knows at all for sure what exactly has happened to this plane. You know, has it crashed? Did it explode in the air? Has it been hijacked and actually taken somewhere? It's very, very odd. And I think that the presence of the United States and how it has mobilized its military assets to assist in the search and rescue and in the Indian Ocean, along with the Chinese, it does signify that actually, you know, the regional powers and quite important countries are taking this very seriously.
What is your impression on how the countries and how authorities have been dealing with what's happened?
Well, that's a very good question, in the sense that it seems to me that the Malaysian government contributed to add, if you want, a bit of confusion to the situation, because their initial reports weren't particularly clear. They went back and forth in terms of the basic information. So rather than operating as you would expect them to do, in a relatively sort of careful way, giving out information the moment they understood and trying to keep everything else under control, there was that kind of attitude in which they changed slightly the narrative over the days, and as the search and rescue progressed, didn't really help the situation. Additionally, I think the question, or the aspect, the limited ability to have a full control, the fact that the data were not in their hands, so the fact that they didn't necessarily know precisely the dynamics and the mechanics, and especially around the time of disappearance, the fact that we knew that all of a sudden it disappeared and they supposedly it crashed, but then we learn from data collected from other agencies that actually the plane had turned out of its original course and direction, does raise serious questions about the ability of the Malaysian government and their traffic authorities to actually keep their skies under national control.
Is this also a place to criticise how the countries in the region have been playing together when the search of the plane has been in progress?
I mean, from a human perspective, if you just for 1 minute put yourself in the shoes of the people whose loved ones are missing, it's absolutely terrible. I mean, you know, reading back over the timeline and the chronology of events today and going through all the information, I just became more and more confused as I went through. And I think that the authorities have actually handled this quite badly, especially, you know, the Malaysian authorities. The press conference apparently today was a bit more organized, but it has been actually a complete sort of mess and free-for-all, and I feel terrible, absolutely terrible for the people who have loved ones that are missing, because it's just, it's very difficult to keep up with all the twists and the turns. And I also think that you know, the Chinese releasing the statement about they'd found debris, but then it turned out it wasn't. I mean, this has just not been carried out very professionally.
Who should we criticise, actually, when we look at how badly, for example, those press events have been organised?
Well, I think that before addressing the question of who we should be criticising, I think we need also to reflect upon the fact that Southeast Asia, as a region, is a highly maritime-centric type of region. That means that the main fabric that connects the different countries is made of salty blue water. Now, that, by definition, doesn't lend itself to facilitate any type of search and rescue activity. Standard search and rescue activity already is extremely complicated. You need to have highly trained personnel, coast guards, law enforcement agencies to be able to conduct that type of operation. And here what we're talking about is something completely different, on a completely sort of a much larger scale. We're talking about a whole plane disappearing in a relatively large chunk of waters. As a result, I don't really feel like stepping up to the plate and start criticising or pointing fingers, because for anybody else would have been a bit of a challenge, really.
When we look at what's going on over there in the region now, this case has forced the countries of the region to cooperate more. Do you think this is something that could actually also have positive consequences in the future?
I hope so. I mean, you have to always try to take something positive from a terrible tragedy and turn it into a thing that you can focus on and unite around for the future. And I think that, you know, given especially the geopolitical context that this has happened in, with the rising tensions between China and Japan and the rising nationalism that we're seeing in the area, and then, of course, the United States is has pivoted back to the Asia-Pacific region, that is going to be a huge, huge centre of growth and power in the century ahead. It is really, I think, incumbent upon the regional countries to work together, especially when addressing severe security issues like this.
Now, let's stay in Asia, but let's look at what another country has been up to. To look at North Korea's rather skillful techniques in avoiding sanctions. In a report published by the United Nations Security Council, a panel of experts experts said that North Korea has persisted in avoiding UN sanctions, not only by continuing its nuclear and ballistic missile projects, but also by engaging in illegal arms trade. This report outlines some of Pyongyang's techniques to evade those sanctions, including secret communication codes or falsification of ships' logs to avoid localization, for example. Mm. The North Korean embassies in Cuba and Singapore are also alleged to have helped arranging an arms shipment to Cuba in the North Korean cargo ship Chongchongang, intercepted by Panama last July. Alessio, once again, if I can start with you, is any of this surprising in the end?
In a way, it isn't, because you would expect that a country like North Korea, with very limited revenues, has to organize itself in order to retain a certain stream of money coming into the country to survive and to finance its own military and national structures. What I found was fascinating. So, in a way, the idea that they're trying to develop sophisticated techniques to go around and cut corners with the current sanctions, it seems to me pretty logical. You know, you would expect them to try to develop that kind of skills. But what I thought it was absolutely interesting is the level of sophistication and ability of manipulating the world of finance and trade, which suggests that either they have a secret stash of money that they can pay to important lawyers or brokers, or they actually are very clever in sending some of their people to be educated at the top schools in order to develop that skills. So in that respect, I thought it was very interesting how what we're looking here is, you know, that North Koreans are usually portrayed as the perfect villains, you know, this dark empire secluded. I think here what we're looking is an extremely well-organized structure that in order to make profit and retain a degree of good revenues, is organizing itself in order to understand the very world that they're defying.
Are you saying that North Korea is particularly good at evading sanctions compared to other countries, say Cuba?
That is difficult to say. What I would suggest, however, is that provided the state of the economy, the bad state of the North Korean economy, I think it's quite remarkable how they managed to secure that degree of sophistication on the back of a general expectation of serious limitations in terms of how they operate in the international realm.
What is your impression? Who is helping North Korea with all this?
Well, it's probably the usual basket case countries always tend to stick together. What I was quite struck, actually, however, was the involvement of Singapore, which is really quite disturbing and irritating. You wouldn't expect Singapore to normally be in that category, and that's very, very odd. And I'm sure that will have to be looked into in more depth to see what on earth is going on there. But I mean, you know, yeah, Cuba is a usual suspect. No surprise there. I mean, other countries, you would imagine maybe Venezuela or some other
the usual suspects that would be part of that. Also, you have to consider that what it is that they're selling, what kind of product. Mm-hmm. And it's the type of product that only sort of countries at the lower end of the military spectrum would actually go for. So there is the classic sort of situation of demand and offer that kind of balance each other off.
Another interesting thing from today, North Korea has indeed said today that it had nothing to do with a tanker which left Libya with an oil shipment from a rebel-held port in defiance of Tripoli. Though the tanker bears the North Korean flag, Pyongyang has said it has severed ties with that ship as it was in violation of international maritime law. Matthew, does this sound a bit hypocritical considering the report we're discussing here?
Well, you see, I think, you know, this is so interesting in terms of this report, because this highlights really that, you know, sanctions aren't foolproof. And everybody always, you know, immediately says when we've got a big problem with a country, you know, let's slap on, you know, a huge amount of sanctions and all will be well. But actually, we need to sort of, you know, it's a very simplistic, almost two-dimensional response. Because, you know, there are so many ways to circumvent sanctions and to get around them. Look at all the crippling sanctions that were on Saddam Hussein's Iraq during, you know, the 1990s and so on, and how the Oil for Food program was totally corrupt and there were all sorts of kickbacks going on. So I think really Western policymakers have to look very hard at the tool of sanctions, especially now in light of the fact that we've got this terrible problem in the Ukraine, to see how they can be tightened up as much as possible.
So what could that actually mean? How can they tighten it up even more?
Well, what they need to do, first of all, is have to have the ability to bring all of the commercial and business entities into line. Now, that might sound very draconian. However, I mean, for example, there was a case of Credit Suisse, I believe, were found to be in violation of the American sanctions on Iran, and they were charged a massive fine. You have to ask yourself at the end of the day, how on earth could they have been allowed to do that in the first place, in the violation of the law? So I feel as though the legislation must make it quite clear to private sector organizations that they must comply, or else they will face even stiffer penalties than financial fines. Imprisonment. You know, you need to have these chiefs of executives held to account.
Let's take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Marco Sippi, Matthew Jameson and Alessia Patalano. When we return, we'll discuss potential new revelations about the Lockerbie bombing and we'll assess the first year of the world's most popular pontiff, Pope Francis.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight. From New York to Nairobi, Bamako to Berlin.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delaunay. From Monocle.
From Monocle.
In Tel Aviv.
From Monocle.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dane.
From Monocle, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
In Bogota.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
So, whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the must-sees at the latest film festival, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It is just 21 minutes past the top of the hour. Still with me are Matthew Jameson and Alessia Patalano. Well, there is no lack of conspiracy theories around the Lockerbie bombing of the Pan Am Flight 103 from Frankfurt to Detroit in 1988. The attack was claimed by Libya's former leader Muammar Gaddafi, and yet a new documentary by Al Jazeera claims that it was Iran, not Libya, behind the bombing. Iranian defector and former intelligence officer Abolghasem Meshbahi says in the document that the flight was taken down in retaliation for a US Navy strike on an Iranian commercial jet 6 months earlier, in which 290 people died. Let's hear a clip.
The target was to copy exactly that's what's happened to the Iranian Airbus. Everything exactly same, minimum 219 people dead.
That was a former Iranian intelligence officer speaking to Al Jazeera. Now, how credible are these allegations, Matthew?
Well, I think that you have to take them very seriously. I mean, he is a former Iranian intelligence officer, and he is now under a witness protection program in Germany. It's very curious. I had not really come across the angle about the U.S. Navy destroyer bringing down the Iranian commercial airliner in July 1988, and. Then, of course, you know, in December 1988, then you have, you know, the Lockerbie bombing. Now, what I find most disturbing is if this is true about the allegation that the British and American governments actually may have known about this and covered it up and steered away the aspect of the Syrian involvement, because of course there was the Iranian intelligence officer said that the Syrians were also involved in getting this Palestinian extremist group to carry out the bombing. And of course during the first Gulf War the Americans were very keen to have Syria involved in the coalition against Saddam Hussein. So whether or not that was a trade-off remains to be seen.
So how much do we actually know for sure about this story? Why do we continue to look for the perpetrators when Gaddafi actually paid compensation to the families of the victims and accepted responsibility for the attack?
Well, I think part of it is that's because we don't really have a clear sense of closure with it. You know, this is an event that is still living in our memories. This is something that also speaks volumes of the complexities of the region. You know, the intrigues, the connections, the links between the official, the quasi-official, the what is on the surface, what lies beneath it. I think it speaks to this sort of deep-seated fears about a general lack of understanding of the internal dynamics of the regions that could see actually Iranians and Libyans connected together, or maybe the Iranians doing something and then the Libyan government claiming for it. I think, you know, if you think about what the situation is on the ground today in the region, there's lots of stories that suggest a similar complexity.
Yes, I was just going to ask why Gaddafi would have accepted the responsibility if it actually wasn't Libya behind the attack.
Well, I think that his son has actually said that the reason that was done, it was a pure political act of expediency, because he wanted to get the sanctions lifted by the West and to start all these lucrative oil deals with BP and so on. And really, you know, it was just a question of this was a major irritant that needed to be addressed, and therefore, you know, he had calculated that actually what he would get in return by admitting, you know, was far greater than not.
Too tempting for him, simply. Well, let's end on a more positive note. Today marks the first year of Pope Francis in office at the Vatican, and he has managed to woo a large part of the Pope haters. He has spoken in favour of gay rights, and he has managed to present a more humble face of Catholicism. On this morning's Globalist, we heard from David Willey, senior Vatican correspondent. Let's hear what he had to say.
Pope Francis marks a real change in style. It's, I think, his very modest, approachable way of speaking, which attracts Italians. And the curious thing is that I remember a year ago when we were all discussing feverishly who was likely to be elected to succeed Pope Benedict after he resigned, we said to ourselves, well, of course, what is really important is that he should be a fluent English speaker. Well, guess what? Pope Francis is not a fluent English speaker. He understands English, but on the rare occasions I've heard him trying to speak the language, it's almost unintelligible. But it doesn't seem to matter. He gets his message across in Italian or in Spanish, and the message he has of mercy and tenderness and not being judgmental about people who disobey church rules has touched millions of people all over the world.
That was David Willey, senior Vatican correspondent. Well, Alessio and Matthew, has this first year of Pope Francis in office actually been that big a success on all accounts?
I think it has, in a symbolic and you know, in terms of a PR way, you know, superficially on the surface it has. He's made all these sort of, you know, comments and gestures and made the right nods, and it's all been very refreshing. However, you scratch beneath the surface, and of course, there's still very, very deep issues that have to be addressed that have not been brought forward and updated with the modern world, and he's got to have to carry along a lot of ultra-conservatives, so the reckoning still has to happen.
Do you agree, Alessio?
Absolutely. I think he was facing two important challenges. The Catholic Church had lost a part of the moral ground, its moral standing, because of the structural corruption in it. And it was losing, on a second level, it was losing touch with its own community. So it was a question of not only restructuring the message, but also the institution that should deliver that message. And if you aren't on top of this, he had a third challenge, that is the evolving nature of its own community. One of the interesting things about it is that the largest and the fastest growing communities of Catholics around the world are no longer in Europe. So the comment that the correspondent was making about, you know, him not being fluent in English, it's quite interesting. But at the same time, I think it gauges something that is a reality. That is, you know, South America, Africa, these are the places where Catholic is growing, and this is the type of people that he should be able to get in touch with and kind of like bridge them towards the type of middle liberal line that we've seen in Europe over the past few months.
Matthew mentioned earlier that ultra-conservatives that he kind of has to drag behind. And when we look at what Pope Francis has actually succeeded in during the first year, could we have expected more from him? Has he actually done everything he has had the opportunity to do in the end?
I think we couldn't have expected any more, really, in his first year. And he had to sort of take, you know, a step-by-step, softly approach. The paradox is, actually, for the Roman Catholic Church, their growth numbers are going way up, you know, in Africa and Asia. But in Africa, of course, the Roman Catholic population are very, you know, traditional and conservative in their social views. So the growth that's coming through there will actually perhaps make it harder for him to liberalize and take the church in a more progressive direction.
And talking about that more progressive direction, how big are the chances that his successor could destroy this relatively liberal legacy?
I think he's a Jesuit. We must remember that. That is very important because it means that is someone that will allow dialogue. I mean, Jesuits have a decision-making process by which they all discuss subjects in a very open fashion before taking a position. That doesn't mean that they don't have rules or that they don't have a sense of direction. It means, however, that they try to the very last breath to sort of bring the widest possible community towards the same sort of understanding. And I think that is going to be one of the key elements to see and to look after for the next year, to get a sense of how successful this Pope will be. Will he be the man that allows people to engage with the dialogue and then steer them towards the direction? I'm sure he has.
Alessio Bartolano and Matthew Jameson, thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House.
Thank you.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London, 这是 Monocle 24.
Op London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda,
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
On the second half of today's edition of Midori House, we'll talk to the author of a book that claims that the separation between East and Western Europe has remained well after the fall of the Berlin Wall. We'll also be in Greece and we'll give you our weekly books review. But before we get started on all that, here is David Spencer with the world news headlines.
Marcus, thank you very much indeed. Russia has increased tensions with Ukraine by beginning a military exercise with more than 8,000 personnel involved. The drill, taking place close to the border with Ukraine, comes ahead of a referendum on Sunday in Crimea on whether to become part of Russia. A German court has sentenced the president of Bayern Munich Football Club to 3.5 years in jail for tax evasion. Uli Hoeneß admitted he evaded 27.2 million euros in taxes on income earned in secret Swiss bank accounts. At least 69 people have been killed in an attack on a group of villages in northwestern Nigeria. Police say the attack is not linked to Islamist militant group Boko Haram. Officials in Malaysia say Chinese satellite pictures of debris in the South China Sea are not connected to the missing airliner, Flight MH370. The photographs taken on Sunday emerged late on Wednesday and show three objects in the water. The European Commission has warned Italy it has to respect EU budget rules on lowering its debt and deficit. The warning came a day after Prime Minister Matteo Renzi announced a sweeping package of tax cuts and spending pledges. Austria has arrested Ukrainian businessman Dmytro Firtash at the request of the United States. He's one of Ukraine's richest men and is suspected of violating laws on bribery and forming a criminal organisation in the course of foreign business deals. Those are latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, David Spencer. Welcome back to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24. I am Markus Hippi. It is time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world, and today we head to Greece to check in with our Athens correspondent, Natalie Savarikas. Welcome to the programme, Natalie. Shall we once again start with the latest on the state of the Greek economy and what to do with it?
Absolutely. Well, what we have is the inspectors, the international inspectors representing the European Union, the IMF, are actually in town again for their usual review. Now, for once, the fiscal gap of the country is no longer an issue. We have good news on that. There, it looks like Greece will have a budgetary surplus for 2014. Nonetheless, as usual, we still have some sticking points that needs to be cleared. And negotiations have started today and are set to conclude on Sunday. At least that's a deadline that we've been hearing. Now, what do the inspectors insist upon? Well, first, they insist upon mass redundancies in the public sector, which the government here is opposed to. It's really under pressure. Yesterday we had a 24-hour strike from public servants. They're opposed to it. And also, of course, what they want is an implementation of some recommendations by the OECD to abolish some regulations that allegedly hamper competition here. And of course, they're finding it very difficult to implement these because they say that, first of all, they go to the core of Greece's tradition on the one hand, and of course, they also include many labor regulations which the Greek labor force is opposed to.
And when you talk about the pressure the government is facing at the moment, when you look at popularity of different Greek parties, how much of that pressure does actually derive from the recent polls?
Well, indeed, for the first time actually, since the beginning of this year, New Democracy, which is at the helm of the coalition government, is suffering. It's trailing behind the main opposition party, which is left-wing Syriza. And they're trailing behind by at least 1%. And that's according to most polls that have been published in the past few months. And that's the first time that this has happened since the government was elected into power a few years ago in 2012. So they're really feeling the pressure, especially as the municipal elections and, of course, the European parliamentary elections are just around the corner in May, which will prove essentially a big litmus test for the rule and the administration of the government for the past 2 years.
Natalie, shall we move on to your second story for today? Shall we talk about what's going on with 2 million euros discovered from a Swiss bank account? 2 million euros that actually belonged to the wife of a former socialist minister.
Indeed. Now, this is really going to the core of what the Greeks have been protesting about for the past years. It's essentially the widespread corruptions and bribes. And Greeks have been accusing their politicians of being embroiled in all that. And it seems that their accusations are not unfounded. Yanos Papandreou used to be a finance minister around 10 years ago. He was also a defense minister, and that defense post seems to be costing him a lot of money because he was essentially accused of accepting bribes. Now, they found 2 million euros in a Swiss bank account of his wife. Her name, was included in the famous Lagarde list that was then the French finance minister, Christine Lagarde, currently the IMF head, who handed over this list of many people, businessmen and politicians in Greece, to her then counterpart, who could be potentially tax evading. And of course, Yanos Papandreou is refuting all this. He had in the past been accused of tax evasion for wrongly declaring his possessions. And this has resurfaced. So yesterday, the wife was being interrogated by the examining magistrate. The case is still ongoing.
And Natalie, let's leave the money issues for now. And let's talk about a controversial decision by Greek archaeologists. Basically, Greece is going to rent out two historic structures for private functions. What does that actually mean? Are you Greek? Are you going to have your Christmas parties somewhere in really valuable locations in Greece now?
Well, that is a way to put it. We're all pretty surprised, though, by the decision of the Archaeological Society to accept for private entities to hold functions in these historic sites, one of them being the Panathinaik all marble stadium, which was built on the ruins of an ancient stadium. It was built to host the modern day Olympics, and it hosted the first ones in 1896. Now, the archaeologists argued that they accepted to host these private functions. Of course, Greece is going to be paid for this, and God knows they need the cash at the moment. But they said the reason they approved this request is because both events that will be held in May and June are a high-end event. One of them will have an event dedicated to the Olympic ideals, whereas the other one will host classical music. But of course, the big question here is, where does this stop? Will this also include in the future other historic buildings that are very dear to Greeks? Now, and of course, the big controversy about all this is, yes, these events are high end, but they will include dining and wining and dining. And that was also a big disagreement and a divided archaeologist on whether this should be acceptable. Now, of course, this has divided society. It has raised a big discussion on whether this should go on. And of course, the big question and the most important one is, where does one draw the line?
Exactly. I reckon that discussion will continue in Greece. Thank you very much, Natalie. That was Natalie Savarikas, Monocle's Woman in Athens. Up next, we'll discuss culture clashes in Europe, East and West, with author Agata Bizik. Stay tuned to find out more on this episode of Midori House here on Monocle 24.
Should cities ban the car? Can we make truly sustainable metropolises? What happens if neighbourhoods lose their corner shops? How do you put a stop to suburban decay? Do children belong in big bad capitals? Can Detroit be saved? Can Sydney become a cycle capital? Can we learn to love concrete? And are rich cities always boring? If you want the answers to the big questions facing our cities, you need to tune in to The Urbanist, Monocle 24 Radio's weekly show about the cities we live in. Expect global reports, great interviews, passionate debate, and some surprises too, because drag star taxi drivers, love motel owners, and retail rebels also get their say. Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 hours London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
The entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages, and the successes of the business world. Every week, we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious, and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
It is a beautiful brand that it's all about giving the consumer the best possible product. We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
We put a shingle on the door, so to speak, which said brand strategy company 25 years ago, and people thought we were just mad parts and really didn't get what we were about.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana, the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
You get obsessed about the details, and if you're making the same product day in, day out, you build this incredible product that is very difficult to replicate.
So if you have an idea and want to drop that 9-to-5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Marco Sippi. It is 22:43 in Moscow, 18:43 here in London, 11:43 a.m. in San Francisco. Poor but sexy. That is how author Agata Bizik sums up Western Europe's vision of the East. Poor but sexy, culture clashes in Europe, East and West, is the full title of her new book, where she explores the difficult relationship between the old continent's Eastern and Western countries. Bizik argues barbecues, Eastern Europe has turned into a destination for cheap stag parties, while the West is still the reliable financial hub where people go to work. After the fall of the Berlin Wall, she continues, Europe remains as divided as ever. To discuss this further, I'm delighted to say that I'm on the line now with Agata Pusik, who is in Warsaw. Welcome to the program. Agata, you have worked as a journalist. What made you want to write a book about the East-West relations of Europe?
I mean, first of all, of course, my personal experience. I came to London at the beginning of 2010, but actually, unlike most of my compatriots for whom the UK has opened the work markets, a few years earlier, I came from a different position because I actually have fallen in love, and I was actually observing the whole thing from a kind of position of somebody who wasn't really prepared for a full-time migration, and I kind of noticed the kind of emergence of a wholly new world and a wholly new infrastructure, the cheap flights, cheap airlines, and kind of whole job market for people from my country who were coming en masse. By now nearly 1 million people, 800,000 Poles, but also from other, of course, Eastern European countries that joined the European Union in the recent years. And kind of I've noticed that there is this whole parallel world and nobody's actually really writing about it. And the kind of, also the emergence of kind of completely schizophrenic, discourse about it, different in the Eastern Europe and different in the UK or, just in general, Western European countries that opened those markets. Like in the UK, Eastern European migrants started to be blamed on, all of the kind of atrocities of the recent financial crisis and kind of scapegoated. And of course, my country, on the other hand, is trying to kind of neglect at all the existence of that, because that would, for instance, get in the way of kind of creating the image of successful Poland or successful post-communist East. And to my surprise, nobody was really writing about it. And I was prepared that actually there will be books about it or research, but actually it didn't exist.
And when you mention the division between Europe's East and Europe's West, how much is it in the end about money, and how much is it about different ways of seeing the world?
I mean, it's both. It's everything, and the book is by no means is concentrating on the economical factors, because my idea about it was to create a multi-level narrative that would, for people, for instance, who for Anglos or for British or for just in general people who are kind of meeting at the workplace or in any other circumstances, meeting those Eastern Europeans, they don't really know what circumstances they come from, and it was kind of, it was to kind of bring back, and that's why the book kind of decides to come back to the past and to the era of the Cold War, to kind of show that those relations weren't established like yesterday or since the accession to the European Union, but it has actually at least several, decades, since the Second World War tradition, if not more, and despite I say that the East stays East and the West stays West, one of the kind of actually huge threats of the book is that actually how similar people has become.
It sounds like you've set yourself on a mission to create mutual understanding. So if we come to those things, if we look at those things, we should learn from each other. What should the Western Europeans actually learn from people from Eastern Europe?
To cut the very long story short, as I said, that especially since the financial crisis in 2008, that those differences are becoming smaller and smaller, because we see, fascinating, for instance, from the perspective of an Easterner idea that the West that we were perceiving as this kind of, richer and so much better than us is actually now undergoing a huge collapse. So that, for instance, people from Spain or people from Italy come to Germany or even to Poland to look for work. And, and obviously to the UK, that UK is this country that actually, despite, huge internal problems, is still attracting, all of those migrants. So what they could learn is that they are not people who are, there to kind of steal their jobs, or they are not a competition, but they are actually have a lot in common, with each other in this kind of global market that actually puts increasingly everybody to the same position.
This global village of ours. And in the end, to create, when you talk about this division between East and the West, what can we do actually to bring Eastern Europe and Western Europe closer to each other?
I mean, one of the things that I, despite, of course, as I say, those differences are melting, I'm actually also arguing that some of them, those differences are good, because what actually happened after 89 is that, you know, Eastern Europe, post-communist Eastern Europe was very often patronized, and kind of other people were deciding our destiny. For instance, you know, that Poland is going to join NATO, or, you know, the kind of protectionism emerges. And for instance, at the moment, a little bit, there is now this, of course, this dramatic situation in Ukraine that is like, once again, despite 25 years since the end of the Cold War, once again, other countries decide the destiny of other countries. And I want this kind of, you know, the kind of the Eastern Europe to speak its own voice, to speak back, to kind of tell their own narrative, completely different than you know, the stereotypes. So I'm actually not really all for neglecting those differences, at least in terms of you know, trying to speak for yourself and decide about your own destiny.
Arkadiusz Bizsik, author of Poor But Sexy: Culture Clashes in Europe, East and West. Thank you very much for this indeed. We continue today's edition of Midori House with a bit of music. This is Don't Wanna Dance by Mo. From Copenhagen, that was Don't Wanna Dance by Myrrh. You're listening to Midori House, you're on Monocle 24. Now, do you need reading recommendations? Don't go anywhere, it's time for our weekly books review now. Today we talk to Parul Segal from the New York Times Book Review. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
You have chosen two books for us. The first one is Bark by Laurie Moore. How would you introduce that book for us?
Well, Laurie Moore is the sort of master of the American short story, and this is her first book in 16 years. But at the same time, her influence is just pervasive. You can hear her in Lena Dunham's show The Girls. You can hear her in Tina Fey. It's her sensibility is that kind of sort of wry, detached musing on romantic failure and dissolution with a political edge. These are 9 stories set in the shadow of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. So there is some kind of political engagement.
And
but they're very funny.
And also when I've been reading some reviews already, and from what I've heard, there's also some rather interesting humor in the book.
Absolutely. Her mantra seems to be like, you know, suffering is inevitable, but suffer in style. You know, so her characters say incredible things, like if you're suicidal but you don't actually kill yourself, you become known as Rai. So they're meddlers and bunglers, and always redeemed by their wit.
And when you think of this book and to what you thought of it, what would you criticize? Did you completely love it, or do you think there would have been something to be improved in that book?
Well, I think that fans coming to this book might feel like it's not one of her strongest collections. That would probably be Birds of America, which came out, I think, more than 20 years ago. This collection feels a bit more searching. It feels a little bit more like she's fumbling to find her next voice, her next great subject. So it does feel like one of those transitional books, but from a writer who matters immensely.
And who are the ones who are going to love this book?
Who else would love this book?
Who would you think? Who are the people who are going to be loving this book?
Oh,
what kind of audience?
I kind of feel like if you're interested in language, if you're somebody who loves puns and sharp wordplay and that sort of thing, I think you're going to find this it's going to be catnip for you.
Definitely sounds very promising. Let's continue with your second book for this day.
Well, my second one is a bit more grim, but there are moments of just terrific black humor. It's by a young former Marine named Phil Cly, who served 13 months in Iraq. And This is his debut book, but it's immensely assured. There are 12 stories, each told from a different voice, describing the war in Iraq. And it is somber, it is harrowing, but at the same time, it is very, very playful, and there's a lot of insidery jokes about the military. For example, there's one chapter that's told almost entirely in acronyms, which of course the military loves. So it is creative and experimental while trying to, represent and sort of be truthful to suffering and loss and pain.
And considering how many war veterans there are around the world, it sounds like there could be some kind of a demand for this kind of book.
I think so. And I think that's really what sort of motivated the writer when he was talking about isolation. It's very hard, he says, to describe war if you haven't been there. And how do veterans and civilians talk about war? He actually has this old joke he quotes in the book. How many Iraq veterans does it take to screw a light bulb? And the punchline is, you weren't there. So he's trying to bridge that. He's trying to create a more interesting and shared vocabulary for war, whether or not you were there.
And it sounds like this book has actually been getting extremely good reviews already.
Yeah, it's really being celebrated. It's really being called an heir to books like the classic The Things They Carried by Tim O'Brien. It is, I think, one of the interesting things about it also is that it is told in so many voices deliberately, so there can't be just one narrative about the war or one narrative about Iraq. So it does feel very expansive.
Thank you very much. That was Parul Segal from the New York Times Book Review reviewing these two books for us. The first one was indeed Bug by Laurie Moore, and the second one was Redeployment by Phil Kai. And that's already all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests Matthew Jameson and Alessio Patalano, and to Parul Segal, of course, as well. Today's show was produced by Daphne Denis, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Christy Roma. Our studio manager was Alex Funnell. Stick around, because next we are joining Andrew Tuck for The Urbanist. This week it's all about the people who are helping to convince policymakers, business leaders and public of how we should or shouldn't be building our cities. What part do lobbyists play in shaping our cities?
The narrative of the city is shaped by the global economy. We're a participant in that global economy. It's shaped by the wills and passions of over 8 million people, and it's shaped and managed by the mayor.
This show will be back at the same time tomorrow at 1800 hours London time, but for this edition of Midori House, it is goodbye. Thank you for listening.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. 1 year can inspire a lifetime. Rolex.